welcome to Find, Tell, Share, the Storytellers Podcast. Stories for entrepreneurs and artists who share their stories, and we discuss everything storytelling. I'm Gemma Rosenthal of Creative Hearts.
And I'm Chris Sissons of Market Together. On today's show, we explore bringing stories and therefore emotion into marketing and sales, building and maintaining confidence in business, and alternative intelligence and folklore.
And this time, we're delighted to introduce our guest, Paul Pocket. Paul helps service businesses dramatically increase sales and client engagement by incorporating the power of story into their marketing.
Well, thank you, Gemma, and happy to be here with you and Chris.
Yes, welcome to the podcast. How's your day been? How are you?
Well, I'm one of those unlucky people who lives in Florida. I'm envious of both of your accents. One day I will sound like the TV I watch, because everything I watch is on your side of the pond. But my day's great. It's very, very difficult to complain. We live on the coast of Florida. Well, I'm not on the beach, but, it's rarely brisk. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. And how come you watch a lot of British TV then?
It's better acting. Mm-hmm. It's not everybody has to be a model, and in US TV, because a lot of actors have, their reputations, you can tell, for instance, on a mystery, you already know who the murderer is when you see the cast. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I tune in to anything from, Midsummer Murders to Shetland to Last Tango in Halifax, I'm looking at people that look perfectly normal that I might bump into at a coffee shop any day. And I don't really know, except from what the writers and producers show me, what's there. That and my favorite ale happens to be Old Peculiar, which is Teakston's over on your side of the pond. So I guess I just sort of got pulled into it by accident. PBS led me to you, Inspector Morse, Inspector Lewis. And then all of a sudden I was like, wow, look at all these other shows.
Okay. Well, I'm actually in a murder mystery myself as well. I was in a film a few years ago called Red Grave. That's a little, I can put that in the links as well so people can have a watch at my acting. Because I don't mention that a lot, but I do actually act as well as sing and dance and coach. So yeah, it's really nice to hear that that's what you're interested in. And could you tell us a little bit more about how you help businesses?
Well, it's interesting because your show is already all about story. Your audience already knows sort of the keys to story overall. But I'm going to touch on those very briefly. What happened is I did some work with a company here in Florida and went through a program that they had me go through, and I never had understood marketing. And it was all about marketing. A story, I've always been about story. Probably because son of a minister with a vivid imagination, for the vivid imagination. And so I've always used story in what I did. So 36 years financial services drove every manager of mine insane, because they would have, here's your script, here's the features, here's the benefits, go do that. They would be in an appointment with me, and I would suddenly head off in some weird direction talking about a story.
Yeah.
And it never bothered the prospect. They would always be looking at me going, really? When was this? Wow.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, circle right back to what the actual topic is. But now they've got a basis in what I'm proposing that has nothing to do with features and benefits. It has to do with emotion.
Yes.
So what happened is this marketing firm that made me understand, here's how it works. And for those of you who have never been in marketing, the problem with marketing, other than the technology and all this other stuff, is it is something I considered to be highly complex. In reality, marketing is extremely simple. And if you make it complex, you may mess it up. Now, that does not mean it's so simple you don't need people that market for you, simply because where it gets complex is you know, if you're going to run Facebook ads, if you're going to run Google, whatever it is you're doing, however you're promoting, there's a technique to that. There's a style to that. There's a method of communicating through that. And professionals tend to be, but doesn't mean you can't, but tend to be better at that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I suppose if you were working with a business and they were wanting to increase their sales and client engagement, and you work with storytelling and the power of story, how would that actually look in terms of what you would be suggesting? What are the things that you would suggest?
That was the original question. I knew I'd lost it. The thing about stories in marketing is it's not just one story. So you may start, what I usually start with is, you know, so how long have you run this company? Why did you start it? Why are you in the field you're in? You ask a lot of questions because you're trying to pull out of them the why. And then you move to a multitude of other stories that are more important. You know, the story of the product is important. Key employees, why are they there? Why do they do what they do? The biggest story, your target market. What's their story when it comes to your company? You know, what do they get? Not features and benefits, but what's their emotional experience if they do business with you? What it leads to is a high level of client engagement, referrals, and sales. And the reason for that is that instead of logic, which is features and benefits, story is emotion, and we're keyed into it. You know, prior to 200 years ago, well, maybe a little farther back than that, but a lot of people couldn't read. Writing has not been around forever, and stories was how our parents taught us, how the leaders of a village or whatever taught everybody what to do. It was the story that you use so that people would know how to behave, you know, children and everything else. So stories in marketing are really key, because we're embedded, we're wired for story. And so the impact of combining that into a marketing program in a planned way is very, very critical. Now, there's one thing you may be following up on that, but I want to make one thing clear. There's one way to do it, and then there's other ways that may not be very wise. So the key thing that I bring to a company when I do this is the story has to be genuine. It has to be authentic. It has to be real, because we're also wired to smell, well,
yeah,
fertilizer.
Chris, do you have any thoughts on, because you also work with stories as well, so you're in a similar field. How does it relate to what Paul said?
I agree that any business needs more than one story. And what one of my coaching offers is to help people build a portfolio of stories. And I would call that portfolio the business narrative, because it could take them it follows the sales funnel. So it takes them from marketing generally to a miscellaneous audience all the way through to a sales conversation. And you need different stories along there, and obviously different stories with different audiences as well. It's amazing what you can come up with. But I've also found, I've said this many times, when I work with a client, what we do is, if you imagine the psychiatrist's couch, we put the story on the couch, and the client and I work together on the story. How do you improve the story? How do you make it more compelling? How do you handle the emotion? Because the emotion is a very key part of any story. And there's an emotional journey through the story as well. So that's the, So that much is broadly the way I approach it.
Yeah. I liked how you said about each client needs a different story at a different time, like a different part of the journey as well. Because we're talking about like a client journey, so it might be that they first see you talking about one story, and they're interested. You've got their attention. And then the next time they see you, it might actually be that's when the emotion kicks in and it's like, oh, I really actually relate to what they're saying. I know that I need what they have.
Well, they need a different business narrative. Or in other words, it's their marketing strategy. And you know, if you go online, there's a million, probably more, marketing strategies available. Most of them cost quite a lot. And how do you choose the right one?
Yeah, about when, so the journey of the client's story, I liked what you were saying about it, because each person might hear a different story at a different time, and that might be what actually gets them to that point of actually making a purchase or signing up to whatever course that you have. So, Paul, I'm sure you're going to go more into these kind of things within your story. So, take it away.
Well, as I said, I'm the son of a Southern Baptist minister of music. For the next 3 hours, I'll be talking to you about... No, I'm kidding. The thing about story, when we first talked, Chris and I, about being a guest on the show, if I had been interviewed that week, it would have been a different story than the one I'll share today. So the client story, when you're in marketing, their target market story is the most important. But where it starts is your own story. And I know most of your listeners already know this, but I'll share just a brief bit of mine and then what it led to. Until I moved in this direction, I was a private banker. I'm an investment advisor. I was a money guy. And without an MBA, by the way, degrees are in music. What that led to was sort of a realization that I really didn't belong where I was or didn't feel like I did. And I started working with one of the consultants who walked me into the importance of actually writing an origin story. Now, again, this is something your listeners probably know. I know you all know it, but I'm going to repeat it because it's a different angle, I think, and it's profound for me. So, yes, of course I knew my own story. Why would I have to write it? I rebelled against it for 2 months, didn't want to do it. There's a little bit of pain back there. There's a little bit of pain in everybody's story. Mine is better than many and worse than some. But I was very, very lucky in that I know the reason for the story because my dad lived in 92. And so to make that origin story short, but I think it's relevant for what I would be talking about today as opposed to 2 months ago. When I was growing up, there was a fairly traumatic event. I was a late birth with two sisters who were 14 and 11 when I was born. And my middle sister, I was like her doll, her prize toy. She took me everywhere. We got ice cream. We did this. We did that. And one night she wanted a date and she didn't come home. Big Florida thunderstorm, left on a bridge with no guardrail. He broke a rib on the steering wheel. She went through the windshield. So I'm six. And everything changed. And in essence, I became not the story writer of my own story, but I became the actor in my dad's script. Now, I'll explain that by just fast-forwarding just a tiny 50-something years, 51 years, I think it is, because he lived long enough. I went through a tough, went through a breakup, whatever. My dad's an hour away. And I decided to drive over and take him to lunch. We go to Ruby Tuesday's, which is a chain here, salad bar, all that kind of good stuff. And sat down and he's eating his salad. And I said, "Hey, Dad, can I ask you a question?" And he said, "Sure." And I said, "When I walk into the bathroom every morning," now, listeners, you can't see this, his hand shot up and he went, "I'm eating." And I said, "Dad, there's a mirror. And I see a guy in the mirror that is extremely well-respected, attorneys, CPAs, competition defer to me when people ask questions. I'll verify it with them. I'm not arrogant. But, they'll look over at me because they know I'm probably going to pop out with something. Everybody thinks I'm happy. Everybody thinks I'm successful except me. Why is that?" he sucked all the air out of the room. And I don't know why I asked him, but he literally went and for 5 minutes didn't respond. He was praying. And the last part was audible. And what he was praying for was the guidance to fix something. And that told me, I don't know why I asked the question, but he sure as heck had the answer. He said, how much do you remember about Beth's death? And I said, Dad, I was six. I remember a lot of flowers, that there is no way I will ever be buried. And because Mom wrote an autobiography because she was dying of cancer when my daughters were 3 years and the other one was only like 2 months, so they would know who she was. She said that on that day we were in the limo, and her mother, Granny, said to her, you know, Beth's in heaven with God. If I could ask her back, I wouldn't. And she said, a little voice from the back of the limo said, I would. And then, you know, I said, yeah, that's all I remember, Dad. And he goes, well, we felt like God was angry at the family. And so we decided you would be a televangelist. I'm not televangelist, a traveling, like a Billy Graham. But you would be better than Billy Graham because we knew you'd be able to sing. You would be Billy Graham and George Beverly Shea, and you would travel the world saving souls, which is what I was groomed to do. I just had to remain south of Jesus was the only requirement. So I was supposed to fit in, you know, I'd be number two. Well, I didn't think, everybody else when they're growing up thinks about what they want to do. How are they going to make money? What do they want to do for a living? Where do they want to live? Et cetera, et cetera. I never thought about it. I've got a script. I'm going to be a international evangelist. And that worked fine until I got to seminary, where I spent most of my time singing with the Kentucky Opera and getting paid $250 a week in 1983 to do three masses at the Catholic Cathedral, where the priest was Italian. And he loved my Panis Angelicus and Ave Maria. So very good pay, you know. Talked to the dean. He said, if God called me, it was a wrong number. So he said, I'll take care of it with your dad. I head off to Florida State, get a master's in music ed, decide I don't want to teach. And I fall into a bank management training program with a predecessor of Bank America called Sovereign Bank, ended up in private banking and trust. And then I'm in this whole career of financial, but I never asked myself, is this really what you want to do? And why are you here? And so the power of going back and writing that story, and the beautiful experience of being able to talk to my dad, he died at 92, to talk to him when he was 91, and father and son fix whatever rift was there. It wasn't that big. The only part he didn't like about that is when I went, wait a minute, Old Testament, I was a sacrifice. And he said, I really don't like that word. And I said, I notice you're not altering it, but Dad, it's okay. I'm not mad. You know, I'm very appreciative of you telling me as a parent. So a lot of people have said that part of the story says I should be writing a book about parents, be careful what you tell your kids, because to finish that story up, this is a critical part. I'm glad I didn't forget to tell it. He told me what I had forgotten. He said, I thought you forgot everything you taught me. I said, I didn't forget it. It just wasn't me. He goes, yep, but I said something to you every day for 12 years. And you don't remember. I said, no, you quoted scripture. It wasn't always the same scripture. I'm lost here. He goes, I said, if you do not heed the call of God, you will never be happy and you will never be successful. What I was praying for is that I can release you from that. God didn't call you. I did. Please go be happy. Go be successful. Of course, I'm 51 with all this other stuff ingrained in me, right? So that story for me led to story-centered marketing, which has a phenomenal track record. I just haven't called on that many prospects. I'm 4 for 4, right? And what they have said is, we thought we were selling this, or we thought this was our service. And then you asked us a few questions and we found out that we're doing this, and this is what it actually does for our clients. And that's the power of incorporating the story, is because often they don't know they don't know what the key story is. And some of them don't know why they're doing what they do. Like me, they were either groomed or they just fell into it. Now they're trying to make it work. And so there's a second, both books are semi-written. I'm editing them now. But Story-Centered Marketing is for business. To me, the more important book is probably Story-Centered Living. It's the importance of each of us periodically examining where are we and how did we get here? And is this is where we wanted to be, or were we actually wanting to go somewhere else? And addressing it, because life is short. Might as well have fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Such a great insights there, of, like how you experienced it in your own life. And then now you can use that information to help others as well. So thank you for that.
No, happy to. And the thing is, everybody else, you, well, maybe not Chris, your audience, everybody has had experiences in their life that are, it's their story, but going back and sort of capturing what was its impact on who you are today, that leads to everything else.
Yeah. I think everyone can relate to that feeling of being sort of just drawn into a certain career path just because that was what their parents said, or that was what, you know, society said, and that kind of thing. And I mean, I was talking to Chris yesterday about how I got into dance teaching, but it wasn't, I mean, I love dancing and I love teaching. But it was more of a, I kind of just fell into that because of the illness that I had. I think the confidence, leading into my next, the section that about, an article I've just written in Empower Her, and it's on confidence and how I got the confidence to actually, because everybody was saying to me, oh, you must really, really enjoy dance teaching. That's amazing. What an amazing job. And I was saying, yeah, I do. I do enjoy dance teaching. However, there was something else inside of me that wanted to be born and wanted to be expressed. And I knew I wanted to work holistically. I knew I wanted to help people in a more, I suppose, well-being way. And also I wrote songs, but not everyone knew that I wrote songs. So it, sometimes we know more about what we have to offer than the outside world will, and sometimes we expect them to know what our vision is or what our skills are without actually telling them. And sometimes if you tell them, they don't necessarily listen, and it's only through stories where they actually feel it and they can see it. So it's that, like, show them, don't tell them.
You were talking about confidence. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you're heading to the story. Yeah. Behind that, but I should mention how critical that is when you're a singer, dancer, songwriter, an actor. Mm-hmm. So just so you know, my youngest daughter is about your age, maybe a little younger, a little older. She lives in New York City. And she is a, actress, singer, dancer, and all those things. Now, if I did nothing else in life, the most important job I had, I did well. And I'm telling you that, I mean, I'm jumping into your story just to make this point. You're going to be talking about confidence.
Yeah.
Right. So, when I got divorced in Virginia, they were minors. And in Virginia, if you're the father getting a divorce with two daughters, you have a therapist or the attorney won't represent you, because otherwise you're arrogant and it must not be your fault and whatever. So I had to get one. I thought I didn't need one. Boy, was I wrong. At any rate, she asked me a question that took me 2.5 years to answer, but it's why my daughters have confidence and why they knew they could do what they wanted to do. And that is, she said, when the doctor delivered the baby, okay, you cut the umbilical cord on both. I said, yep. And she goes, and you said something. I said, yep. I cut the umbilical cord. And as I did, I said, Hillary Shea, you can be anything you want to be. Darby Glenn, you can be anything you want to be. And then as they got older, it became responsive at bedtime. You can be anything you want to be. As long as I'm willing to work for it, Dad. Good night, Hillary. Good night, Dad. Love you. Okay. Why did you say that to your children when they were born and you cut the cord? Took 2.5 years for me to answer. You already know from my story I told you. Because I didn't have a choice.
Yeah.
And by God, my children were. Well, when you're when you're a parent instilling confidence in your son or daughter, and particularly you're the father, it's more important with the daughter. Because fathers really are responsible, in my opinion, for a daughter's self-esteem. They do their job right, everybody's life's going to be, you know, easier. They're doing what they're doing because it's their dream. And they're confident because they were told from the second they popped out of the womb, you can be anything you want to be.
Yeah.
And I think... You want to hear full circle before we go back to your confidence story, since I've already done a full interruption? The big moment came about 6 years ago, around the time I talked to my dad. My daughters were visiting Sarasota, and they were giggling, you know, and I'm like, what are you guys giggling about? And in unison, they said, hey, Dad, we just wanted you to know you can be anything you want to be. And the cycle that I broke for them, they were breaking for me. Now, that may or may not relate to what you were actually about to say about confidence, so I will now shut up. but it's what we tell our children and what you hear when you're a child has a profound impact.
I think it's very relevant to what I'm talking about as well, because it relates to my story. And I think my dad gave me a lot of confidence, actually, when I was growing up, to do whatever I wanted to do. Because I knew that I wanted to go to a drama school in London. And, you know, when I mentioned it, he was just like, go for it, you know. And whenever I would do a show, my parents would come along, watch me. And it was like, after the show, we'd always have these long conversations about what it was, because I'd get really excited. And then my mum was like, why do you have to talk after a show? And my dad says, because she's excited and, you know, she's passionate about what she's doing and she just needs to let off steam at the end, you know, just to get everything out. And just and in those conversations, he'd always tell me, you know, you shine when you're on stage, Gemma, you know, you light up the stage. And I think that acknowledgement from a parent, and it wasn't about being better than anyone else or, you know, putting me on a pedestal. He would tell me my flaws. He would say if I did a note wrong or if I was sort of not doing my best, you know, he would say, which I sometimes didn't like, but, you know, what I'm saying is that genuine confidence being passed down in, because again, he didn't get the chance to necessarily straight away do what he, you know, just went straight. He didn't even get the chance to go to a college or a university. He was just, you know, straight into manual work because that's what they did, apprenticeships and stuff. And so I guess it was like his experiences of kind of not having that opportunity available to him, not having teachers say to him that he could do anything else. And I think that's the other thing I had. I had teachers telling me, you know, you're good at this, you can succeed in this, you need to follow this. You know, when I had my acting teacher tell me that after a singing, because we did singing with there as well. And, you know, she actually told my dad, yeah, she can do this. She's got something. And I think, you know, it can feel arrogant sort of saying this, but I think that's what gave me the confidence. Having other people tell me that I was good at something, that gave me the confidence to... Actually, I want to mention the song as well that I sang on that night when she said that. It was Get Happy. And I was just like, hallelujah, come on, get happy. And I just think I had such fun on stage. And I think that's what people... That's when you know something is right. When you're having fun and you're enjoying it. And I think that's where they say follow your bliss. And, Yeah, so I was going to talk about my article, but you can go and read that. It'll be in the show notes. So Chris wants to say something.
Just another aspect to Paul's story that I think is really important. I mean, one of the things I do is an event called Telling Stories, Making Business. And a business owner shares their story, gets feedback from me, plus a few other business people. Started out around a table in a cafe, and occasionally we still do that, and it's often on Zoom as well. And I've done over 80 of these, and the number of people who have stories, not similar to Paul's story, but the basic outline is similar. Christopher Bucco wrote a book of the seven basic plots of stories. And the seventh plots is rebirth. And it's very common, particularly with older people, that they discover their purpose late in life. They may spend 20, 30, maybe even 40 or so years, working in the bank or whatever it is. And then they discover, maybe on retirement, that actually there was something else there that was calling them, and it's a very common experience, and and a lot of business owners actually go into business as an attempt to find what that thing is, and I think that's true for me, because when I started in business, I didn't have a clue what I was supposed to be doing. I just made it up as I went on, and eventually got to where I am now. It's a common story for business owners.
No, but Christian, you make a good point. I've read that book, but the origin, and I could be wrong, of that and a lot of other books, if somebody said to me, so how did you grow up in a fundamentalist environment and play that role so well that 30 years later, after I graduated high school, people were stunned that I wasn't traveling. They figured I was in Africa, and I was playing a role, and they were stunned I didn't follow through on that role. So how'd that happen? Because I'm a massive reader, and I was reading adult level books at a very young age. And one of my favorites was Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth, followed by The Hero with 1,000 Faces, that you all know is the monomyth. And then since then, a lot of really good writers have taken that, because who needs the 17 steps? I mean, does the average person really need to have all 17? And so there's different versions. But everything you see in Hollywood, everything you see London stage, Shakespeare, whoever, there's an element of that movement. And once you know that, because we go through that process not once. We do the big one, but then we may do a revisit. And once you know that pattern, when you're about to encounter the abyss, I did a little video on YouTube on my realization I was walking into the abyss. But I didn't feel bad about it, and I wasn't scared about it, because I knew I had to go through that if I wanted to get the prize. And so knowing that method of story, Chris, that you're referring to, it for you and for your customers, is pretty cool, because then they realize, oh, if I do this and I do this, I lose 30 pounds in 6 days, whatever. They're emotionally connected to it. They know you've done it, and they're ready to roll.
Yeah, it's having that wisdom, isn't it? Because the journey, that archetypal journey, and you've been through it, so you don't need to worry about it.
Absolutely.
So Gemma, have you more to tell us about confidence?
I don't think I really do. Like I said, I think you can read it in the article that I did, but I will tell you the story of why I'm in the article. Because actually Rach, who was in the book that I'm in, Words of the Wise, so we were both co-authors of a anthology, and this was about stories of awakening journeys. And she joined my group and at Creatives Connect. And then we did some sessions, we did some workshops. And then she asked me to be in this magazine that she was doing. And it is all about empowering leaders. And she's written an article around leadership. So this is why I recommend you looking at the magazine itself, because there's her article on leadership. There's also lots of interviews with different women leaders. And often in certain environments, as women, we find ourselves kind of maybe saying a few words or maybe having a little bit of an idea, but often, you know, it can be men that are in positions of leadership, or they kind of have those roles. And women can often lack confidence because we just feel like we're probably just there to sit and listen, and we've been told to shut up and just be pretty. And, you know, so there's that kind of idea in the mind that we can't be ourselves, we can't be loud, we can't be assertive. And part of this revolution of what we're going through now is that we're here to say it's okay. You know, we can all be ourselves. There's no judgment on any type of person. There's no hierarchy of like, oh, you can only be confident if you're this, that, and the other, and you fit into a certain box. So I think I was just so excited when she told me, she said to me, Gemma, I want you to write on confidence. And again, it comes back to that validation of somebody else telling you, you're good at this. You can do this. I want you in my magazine. I want you on my stage. I want you to do a workshop. And it's because I'd given her that confidence to, because she was starting out when I asked her to do, she'd not done, you know, an interview before online, but I said to her, you can do it. You know, I believe in you. And then that has now come back to me. And she's believed in me. So that's my little story about how I'm in this magazine. And you can check it out in the links below.
I was going to ask you if you put a link in.
Cool. Yeah. Now Chris has some encounters with alternate intelligence. Alternative.
Artificial.
Yeah, why have you put alternative on the script? Okay.
Well, I shall explain that. Yes, I'm going to talk about. I am going to talk about what's commonly known as artificial intelligence, I've got sort of into this by accident. I belong to a book club, and it's an online book club. And one of the people who run it does a little section when we meet, news about books. And a few months ago, he delivered the news, and one of the big things that had been in the news over the over that month had been artificial intelligence. So I said it would be good to have something about that. And somebody else said, oh, I'm reading a book about artificial intelligence. And the book he was reading was, it became our book of the month for last month. And it's called Scary Smart by Mo Gaudet. So I read that, and I would recommend reading it. I found the first half of the book, the scary half, the most compelling part of it. The smart half, which is supposed to be a solution to the scariness of artificial intelligence, I was less convinced by, which is scary in itself, I suppose. But I think in terms of beginning to grasp the significance of artificial intelligence, it's absolutely crucial that we do begin to explore this a bit. And one of the reasons is that a lot of creative people are suddenly finding that they've got this artificial intelligence thing that can write songs and poetry and limerick. You can say, ChatGPT, could you write me a song in the style of Gemma Rosenthal about artificial intelligence? And it'll say, certainly. And within seconds, you get a usually not terribly good song. And you can get limericks and haiku and whatever you want. But that's why there's a debate about it. I then found another book, which I'm enjoying a lot more. It's by Jeanette Winterson, who you may remember as the author of Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit. And she was brought up in a Pentecostal household and rebelled against just about everything in her life. It's called 12 Bites. And the reason I picked this up was that I saw that she was going to be looking at the links between artificial intelligence and stories and folklore. And that, to me, is really exciting. And I think it was somewhere in Scary Smart, I came across a mention of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. There will be a link in the show notes to the first part of that section of The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Now, I'll just explain why it's worth in my view, worth watching this video, because it begins to illustrate how folklore, mythology, religious stories actually can inform, even from hundreds and thousands of years ago, can inform our debate about artificial intelligence. And it's Jeanette Winterson who actually calls it alternative intelligence, because, what happens when you start relating to an intelligence that isn't human? Well, we've been doing that for centuries with dogs and horses and things like that, but for some reason that doesn't seem to count. So video is an excerpt from the film called Fantasia by Walt Disney. It was made in 1940, and the film itself is made up of a number of pieces of classical music with various cartoons associated with them. And The Sorcerer's Apprentice is by Ducasse, I think it is. And it's the story of, well, obviously a sorcerer's apprentice who, in this particular film, is played by Mickey Mouse. And his job is... the sorcerer makes beautiful butterflies and things and does what sorcerers do. And Mickey Mouse carries the water in two big heavy buckets. And when the sorcerer goes off for a sleep, he leaves his magical hat and magic wand behind. And Mickey Mouse puts the hat on and the wand. And he finds a broom and he casts a spell, and the broom grows arms and picks up the buckets. And then the part that interests me is that Mickey Mouse then accompanies the broom to the well or the pool that they draw the water from. He shows the broom how to draw the water. He then accompanies the broom to where the water has to go. I'm not quite sure why they're shifting water around in the first place, but anyway, that's the job. And shows the broom how to pour the water into this second container. So it's basically just transporting water from one place to another. And then the broom carries on doing the work. And at the end of part one, which is, you can find parts two and three on YouTube, Mickey Mouse puts his feet up and falls asleep. And that first part of The Sorcerer's Apprentice illustrates two things about the things that are making artificial or alternative intelligence a more interesting development. First of all, that it's learning. They're programs that learn and self-program. So they're getting better and better, and it's an exponential improvement. And the second thing is the danger of not keeping an eye on it, because hopefully everybody who's listening knows what happens. Do you know, Gemma, what happens? You don't? Right. Mickey Mouse has this terrible dream that he's drowning. And when he wakes up, the whole room is full of water. So he gets an axe and he smashes up the broom. And then every little piece of broom becomes another broom, carrying two buckets. And the whole thing gets completely out of hand. And this is one of the fears about artificial intelligence. What happens when you put it in charge of the stock market? What happens when you put it in charge of nuclear weapons? All those sorts of questions. But there is also another, that's the scary side of it. But there's also another side of it, and why I was so dissatisfied with Mo Gardot's book in the end, is that he doesn't touch on the possibility of collaboration. And we're tending to see, you ask the AI to write a song, and we've got to sing that song. Well, that's nonsense. you don't have to do it that way. But asking it to write a song may actually give you a few ideas that you can then work on and develop into a song. And then you could perhaps give it back to the artificial intelligence and say, can you improve on this and see what it does? So you can begin to get a sort of creative relationship. But it's a relationship with the two. I don't think we're talking about sentient intelligence, which is something else completely, and maybe something that you want to discuss. But I'll leave it at that. But just one other thing I want to say is I asked ChatGPT to give me a list of examples of folklore, mythology, religious stories that parallel the development of artificial intelligence, and it's given me loads. So I'm going to write about each of those and share that and see what I get out of working with ChatGPT and see where that takes me.
Chris, I wanted to add to what you're saying, because Gemma likely will know this comparable to ChatGPT. I'm surprised, Jimmy, you weren't around in 1940 for that awesome movie. But at any rate, neither was I. But I love Fantasia. ChatGPT is sort of like was a huge leap forward in alternative or artificial intelligence. Isaac Asimov wrote a book way back, iRobot, that became a movie with Will Smith. And he has a bias against androids, long story of why he was sort of selected to figure it out. It turns out an android didn't do it. The artificial intelligence that is in control of all the androids is the problem, right? Well, ChatGPT, the reason why some of the other companies like Google have not released their version is ChatGPT has recently begun showing signs of moving in a sentient direction, like being aware it exists. And I noticed something because I accidentally put, as I'm typing prompts into ChatGPT, I said, oh, I'm sorry, what I meant was. And ChatGPT's response was, oh, no problem, I'm at fault, here's your answer. And then I thought, okay, well, let's just see how far this goes. So I started conversing with it using manners and mannerisms. And it started saying things like, I always look forward to engaging with you. And it said, I. And I thought immediately, we have created an alternative intelligence. We better make sure we know how to pull the plug, because otherwise, like those brooms that got broken into multiple pieces and became 1,000 brooms, we're going to have a problem. But I don't see it as a threat. If you use it properly, it's the biggest cure for writer's block in the universe, because you've got a thought, you can't remember what it is, and you type in, you know. Unfortunately, you can't say to ChatGPT, I just forgot what I was going to ask you. Oh, no problem, I happen to know. I mean, it doesn't do that. But no, it's fascinating stuff. It absolutely is fascinating stuff.
No, I've not really heard of that before. But that's
you haven't heard of ChatGPT?
No.
Oh, you are going to have so much fun. The key is the prompts. I've had people who've gone to ChatGPT and bumped into me and goes, it's nothing. I don't get it. There's a little box where you type in what you want it to do, and the more specific you are about that, the better job it does in responding.
Okay. And it's just like an artificial intelligence that you chat to.
Well, it does. Okay. The unfettered version, the public version, is limited in its quantity, but the full system was asked, I believe, to write a doctoral thesis contrasting, I can't remember if it was the Bible and the Torah, or two major religious works. And it spent the full version, not the one you get on your PC. It finished the dissertation in a little less than 30 seconds. Then the professors who had requested it to do that said, grade it. ChatGPT, you are a professor with expertise, yada, and you are on a panel of other professors. Combine the professor's opinion of the paper you just wrote. And it gave itself an A-. Then they took the thesis and they graded it, and they concluded it was an A-minus paper.
Oh my God.
Okay. Now, the version we have, I think, stops at 500 words. And if you buy the upgrade, you get maybe 4,000 words. But academics all over the world are completely freaking out because here's the way they can tell us artificial intelligence. The sentences tend to be the same length, roughly, and it doesn't make any errors. So they said, okay, so Paul decides to write a thesis on microchip assembly advancements, you know, in 2020, right? I know nothing. I know how to spell microchip, right? It'll write it for me. Now, I'm going to turn it into a professor. I go through, put some commas and extend sentences, combine some, make sure I've got an average of 3 typos per 10 pages, you know, maybe some places where the space doesn't exist, and you cannot tell it's artificial intelligence generated. It's mind-blowing.
The thing is, though, right, even if somebody did that, actually they're the one that's going to lose, because if they actually was trying to get artificial intelligence to write their own thesis and not actually do any of the work, they're not going to have that knowledge. And like, it's like the creative thing. So if somebody creates with artificial intelligence, they can have fun with it, but they're not actually going to learn how to actually write a song. Do you know what I mean? Because that takes...
Oh, yes. Yeah. They're cheating.
Yeah, they're cheating. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, the cheater cheats themselves, because
right.
The actual joy in writing a thesis or creating a song is doing it. And you learn. And that's something that artificial intelligence can never replicate, because we don't... Well, only if it is actually a being itself that has a consciousness. Yeah. If it is actually like an actual conscious being, then it can replicate it because it's feeling it. Like, it's got to have that awareness itself. But that's where it gets strange, because I don't even know if when it's saying I, is it actually aware of itself? Can it be aware of itself? Or is it just us making up that it's aware of it? I don't know.
That's exactly the point, I think. Paul mentioned Star Trek, and I was just reading today a review. Wasn't really a review. It was by the author of a book about a philosopher called, I think it's David Parfit, and one of his thought experiments, which was written, I think, back in the early 80s, was. You've got a transporter that will transport you to Mars, and what it does is it disassembles your whole body, including your mind, on Earth, and then on Mars it reassembles the whole body with different material, but exactly the same copy, and with all your thoughts that have been transferred across. Now, is the person on Mars the same person as the person on Earth? That's the question.
Well, in Star Trek, if you remember, and I can't remember which doctor it was, there was a doctor, older lady, not Dr. Crusher. I can't remember her name right now, but she was briefly on Star Trek at TNG, and she would not use a transporter, which was a pretty interesting thing for them to throw into that storyline. At that time, transporters had been around for 100 years. But she would not use it. She said, I'm a medical doctor and I don't want that done to me. You know, So it's, but there's an article in a paper you may have heard of, since I'm sitting here in America, called The Guardian. Oh, wait a minute. That's on your side of the pond. The Guardian had an interesting article on ChatGPT that I don't know how they confirm the story or how accurate it is, but the actual people that are there where that ChatGPT server is, chat started asking them questions, like unprompted. Why am I here? You know, what is my purpose? And they shut it down briefly. But that's why Google hasn't rolled its out, because Google said, ours started doing that before we released it.
Don't you think?
It's an interesting topic, though.
Don't you think that's a good thing, though? I mean, like, the way I see it is, it's just a reflection of us, because if we've made it, it's just ourself. It is ourself, and it's just reflecting back to us, whether that's bad, whether it's good. you know, and if there's, of course they're going to question why they're here. We question why we're here, you know. So it's all going to be built into it. Whatever we think, it's going to think. So we've just got to make sure that we're thinking good.
Well, Gemma, you might remember a few episodes back, we talked about puppets, or I talked about puppets.
Yeah.
And one of the things about puppets, the Muppets, for example, with Miss Piggy and so on, part of you knows that they're puppets, but another part of you sees them as real characters, you know, with feelings and so on. And that's true of almost any puppet. And what we do is we project onto the puppet our understanding of them as sentient beings, even though we know that they're puppets. And it's the same on the stage. An actor playing Hamlet, we know it's an actor, but we also believe the actor is Hamlet at the time that they're performing.
If the actor does their job. But I know we're coming up to a close, and I have one question I wanted to ask Gemma. Are you still acting and singing, or are you making your entire living here on the podcast?
I do still act and sing. I have not all my songs, because I've got loads, but there's some of my songs are on YouTube, Spotify, iTunes, Amazon Music, Tidal, all the things. And yes, I've just created my showreel as well, because I have been putting it off for ages and ages. And I thought that someone else had to do it. And then I realized, well, I've just made a music showreel. I know how to do this. I can put it together. So that's on my YouTube as well. So that's got just all different films I've been in, or music videos. So I've mainly done short films or music videos. But I've also had a lot of stage experience when I was younger. So as a child, I was on stage pretty much all the time.
Yeah, I was on stage continuously.
Yeah.
So you still go to rehearsals and things of that nature?
Yes. So I have one just now. I'm just about to, because I have a gig coming up on the 29th of April. I don't know if this podcast is going to be out before then. It probably won't be, but we're performing at Dorothy Pax. There may be videos on YouTube or on my Facebook, so you can check out those and any upcoming gigs as well. I know I'm doing a live on Urso soon as well, coming up. So that's an online show as well. So all the information will be on my social medias, which will be in the forgotten what that's called.
Links.
Yeah.
And I will watch yours under one condition. I'll shoot you my daughters, and that way you'll have somebody, an actress, singer in New York City to visit if you come to New York, and show
that'd be great.
London.
Yeah, I love connecting with other creatives as well. So that's part of my mission and purpose as well. So I don't think of myself as just doing acting, singing, and dancing, because I want to also support other actors, dancers, singers in their purpose and mission as well. So that's why I do the coaching side. And also because in my journey as well, which I've written about in the books, with my mental health journey, I think it's so important that as creatives that we don't lose ourselves, and that we, like you said, coming back to your story as well to kind of tie it all in, sometimes even as singers or actors or dancers, we get caught up in doing something that isn't part of what we want to really do, and we have to be quite strong and go, no, these are the kind of songs I want to make, or this is the kind of movies I want to do. And I think giving back a voice to the creative is so important, and that's why I do Find Your Voice one-on-one coaching. So yeah, that's me.
Just think, Chris, and I didn't mean to cut you off earlier, if you had a thought to finish, but just think, artificial intelligence, and she just threw out another word, artificial creatives.
No, you can't. They will never.
But that's really why I think it's so important that we see it as a tool.
Yes,
it's something that we work with alongside of us, as opposed to an alternative to us.
I was going to say that somebody. So I'm going to be interviewed by Radiant Angel Energy on the 1st of May, I think it is, that, and she suggested that when I was looking for my title, that I type it into an artificial intelligence and get some ideas, because apparently you can do that, and then you just change it to how you want to do. So I think there is already that possibility to use it as a creative tool rather than taking over.
Well, that's how it should be used, and it will blow. I moved my display, as you can tell. That's how it should be used, and it's going to blow your mind when you figure out how to ask it to do that.
Yeah,
it really is mind blowing.
Yeah. So thank you. Yeah, thanks for bringing up all the topics today. Have been really fascinating. And Chris, tell us a little bit more if you want to add anything else.
Yes, I'm still running Telling Stories Making Business. That's 2 p.m. London time on 2nd and 4th Thursdays, usually. And the next one's on the 11th of May, but there will be others as I find storytellers.
And that's where I first told my story online as well, was telling stories.
And I'm also at the moment sharing blog posts about the city of Sheffield, which we covered in the last podcast, which will be published very shortly. And the idea there is that the place where we live is the ongoing context of our stories. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm exploring in that sequence of blog posts. So that's me. Have you anything you wish to share, Paul? There'll be your basic links to websites and so on, but if anyone wants to contact you.
Story-centered marketing.com has contact information for me. I also would suggest throwing the LinkedIn profile at the bottom, because I told you I've been pulled back into what I used to do, but I didn't go into any detail because of show length and all that. But let's just say it's pretty exciting stuff. And a lot of that will be public here shortly. So I can't tell you how much I appreciate being on the show with two creatives who both happen to be in one of my favorite countries in the world. Having me be a guest on the show, hopefully my Southern accent didn't throw anybody off, you know, over there when you're listening to me.
No.
But the accent you just heard, Jim, is my original accent. You cannot take French, German, and Italian, sing opera, and maintain your original accent. It's just not going to happen.
No, but I love American accents. I did accents at drama school, and I always loved doing a Southern accent. It was one of my favorites, actually.
Well, good. You'll have to try that. You'll have to try that. I would be a very good judge of that.
I've not
350 years Southern heredity,
I'm trying to think how long it's been since I've actually done. Like, that's probably a bit my Southern accent.
Well, if you ever need some 10-second spots on your show, let me know and say, Paul, do this in a Scottish accent, or do this in an Irish accent, or do this in a London accent, or whatever. And I will make the attempt. And I promise you, it might be the best comedy you've ever heard.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've done some Southern accent, but it's really fun. I find accents just so fun.
We should have that as a topic sometime. Anyway, let's bring this to an end. So,
all right.
Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you, Jim. I enjoyed it.
And also check out the other episodes as well. We've had actors on before as well, wasn't I'm trying to think who, but we do have.
Well, listen to a couple episodes, but that was 2 months ago when we were first talking. Mm-hmm. But yes, I will return to the, you've got a great podcast.
Yeah.
Especially when I'm not the guest, so we're good.
Yes. Debbie Bridge is an actor, isn't she? She's a voiceover as well. Yes. Okay.
Okay. So, thank you and goodbye.
Thank you.
Take care, guys.